Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 10th episode of the Forensic Anthropology Companion Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Kennyhurst. To celebrate our first double-digit episode, I was lucky enough to chat with someone who needs no introduction.
Hi, I'm Doug Ubelacher, forensic anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. I've done a lot of casework over the years. My primary interests are in developing new methods, perfecting the methods that we have to learn about people from their remains, and then applying those methods to medical legal cases when I'm needed.
To discuss the historical development of forensic anthropology. So let's get right into it. Could you please give me a quick summary of what you consider to be the benchmark points in the development of forensic anthropology?
Well, it's hard to pinpoint specific benchmark points in the development of forensic anthropology, but I have to start with casework. I think from the very beginning, going back into the 19th century, the field has been driven by casework. It started out with some fairly meager but high-profile cases, but has mushroomed into major involvement worldwide by forensic anthropologists. The casework demonstrates our ability to contribute to problems of society. It also drives our research. As we work on cases, we discover the deficiencies in our methods and can come up with experimental and thoughtful research that will remedy those deficiencies. I'd also have to mention the development of the what was then called the physical anthropology section in 1972. This, for the first time in the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, gave forensic anthropologists an annual meeting to go to present their results, to discuss their cases with colleagues, and I think did a lot to give an identity to the field of forensic anthropology within anthropology and within forensic science. Another major development was the formation of the American Board of Forensic Anthropology in 1977-78. This was another milestone in that for the first time, it offered certification, diplomate status for qualified forensic anthropologists, something they could demonstrate, shows their competence that they've been tested and their peers have judged that they are in fact qualified to get involved in the legal arena. I think the next thing I would turn to is sort of global expansion and interest in forensic anthropology, which we've seen in the last couple of decades. I think this has dramatically expanded the reach of forensic anthropology globally. It has led to new organizations such as the Forensic Anthropology Society of Europe, formed in 2003, and the Latin American ALAF system, also formed in 2003. These organizations have basically provided the same function that the physical anthropology section did in North America, but did it in Europe and in Latin America, and I would argue in other parts of the world as well, through workshops and participation in training. These developments have led to global databases, development of new collections, documented collections that greatly enable the research that we do in developing new methods and giving us a better look at human variation and how that impacts our methods and how we have to take that into account when we apply methods to regional cases.
I love that. Forensic anthropology seems like it's come from this place of need, and we'll get into that with the next question, because in the early 1900s, there was this focus on identification or getting identification opinions. So what was happening in the 1900s that could have led to this application of anthropologists or establishing identity?
Well, I think in the early 1900s, the key development I see, again, it goes back to collections. You know, we begin to see the establishment and formation of documented collections that enable the methods to be developed that have later been tested and greatly expanded. I think what we also kind of see is the evolution of a science in forensic anthropology. As these collections enabled new methods, we've also been able to see more statistical rigor and attention to the probabilities and error assessment. I think an influential person there is Carl Pearson, the British mathematician, 1857 to 1936, who did a lot to inject statistics and mathematical approaches into forensic science in general, but forensic anthropology in particular. He did some work on stature, but I see his major contribution was kind of injecting a mathematical foundation into the science of forensic anthropology. And I think the collections plus that enlarged mathematical base greatly contributed to the development.
I would agree. And then it wasn't too long after that that Fisher comes along and just opens up what is possible with inference way beyond Pearson's wisdom of the crowds, which I still think is a beautiful example of why you should use a median over a mean in certain circumstances. To flesh out the collection's importance, you brought up Blumenbach, Broca, and Lombroso. Could you briefly describe why you consider them key figures?
Well, Blumenbach, like other early European workers, contributed to the very foundational roots of biological anthropology and forensic anthropology. Blumenbach, of course, is best known for his classification of human groupings. He came up with his view of there were five groupings of humans, enlarged on that by one, the system that Linnaeus had previously proposed, and took that classification, as flawed as it was, into discussion of anatomical features, primarily focusing on the head. So it took more of a morphological descriptive turn that ultimately fed into some of the more useful studies that have been done since. Blumenbach also came up with the term coccozoid, which persists in sort of folk classifications today. And some of these terms, the reasoning for these terms have been shot down over the years, but the terms survive and we still have to deal with those. Paul Broca, working in France, best known for his work on the brain. He was a medical researcher, did a lot of work. Broca's areas in the brain is still discussed today, but he also did a lot in anthropology. I think of Broca as two major contributions. One, the development of instrumentation that was later used in a standard way for anthropometry and measuring skeletal material. But he also developed a training school. His institute in Paris, the School of Anthropology, founded in 1876, basically launched training. So here you had a place people could go and be trained in these techniques, how to use these new measuring devices, what measurements to take, and that did a lot of contribute to the standardization. A lot of the names that we know later on studied with Broca in Paris, and I think that was a major contribution there. Cesare Lombroso, I included in kind of an indirect way. He was an Italian professor. His influence was indirect in that he and others of the Italian school at that time, his dates are 1835 to 1909, he sort of championed this idea that aberrant human behavior was rooted in morphology, and that criminal behavior, the insane, various forms of aberrant behavior could be traced to physical characteristics. And this thought dominated a lot of discussion back then. And although it's been shot down over the years, it led to the search for the development of collections and the search for data that could test those hypotheses. As we'll maybe talk about later, this is what led Ella Sherdliska in the United States to start forming the collections in an attempt to discern differences between normal people and abnormal people. And that, of course, led to debunking the Italian theories, but it entered those people building those collections into the world of anthropology. In building up those collections, ultimately they gave a foundation to form what we later know as forensic anthropology. So Lombroso had an impact, although it wasn't the one that he intended, but I think it's in the long run been a very positive impact for the development of forensic anthropology.
And I would say too, Lombroso, and if anybody has not seen what Lombroso's contributions were, you can find his drawings, the illustrations online of his different criminal types and different aberrant normal behavior types. It's worth looking into just to see what those are. But I would argue that our development of using morphoscopic traits could be traced back to this type of work or this type of line of thinking, even though now we incorporate more biological and evolutionary theory as opposed to just societal impressions. So it seems like a lot of the early development of forensic anthropology was based to fill this need of the time. And I'm talking now specifically about the United States and the Parkman and Lutgard cases.
Well, the Parkman and Lutgard cases have been talked about a lot, and they're basically historical, very high-profile cases that demonstrated the role and the risks of anthropologists getting involved in medical legal cases. The Parkman case dates back to 1848. It was situated in Boston in Harvard University. Parkman was a fairly high-profile benefactor of Harvard, and he not only contributed to the development of the facility, but also helped some of the professors when they had financial needs. In particular, he had loaned money to a faculty chemist named John Webster, and Webster apparently had trouble meeting his obligations with Parkman. Parkman, according to the accounts, visited Webster one day to talk about the need for him to pay up, and Webster was convicted of murdering Parkman at that meeting. Webster apparently disposed of the body by dissecting it, burning parts in the local furnace, and putting the other parts into the local sewage system. These materials were later retrieved, and as you can imagine, a very high-profile trial came out of this involving a Harvard professor and a Harvard benefactor. And basically, the anthropologist anatomist Jeffries Wyman testified in that case. I don't think the testimony was particularly controversial. He basically demonstrated that, yes, these parts could have come from the same person and were consistent with what was known about Parkman. Nothing very controversial about the testimony. The importance was just the high-profile nature of the trial and the fact that they brought in an anatomical specialist to give evidence for that. The Ludgard case is a different one. It took place in Chicago. Adolf Ludgard was a owner of a local sausage factory in Chicago, apparently had marital troubles, was accused of killing his wife and disposing of her remains in one of the vats at the sausage factory. Very, very colorful case. Eventually, some very small fragments were recovered from this vat, apparently placed in potash in the vat. Very small fragments were recovered. Again, a very high-profile trial. And the local anthropologist, George Dorsey from the Field Museum, was brought in to testify. This testimony was controversial in that Dorsey gave a lot of interpretive information about these very small fragments that was heavily criticized by the defense and in the media. I think that may have led George Dorsey to leave the field. We don't hear much about George Dorsey in forensic anthropology after that. He went off to do other pursuits. But it was, again, a high-profile exposure of forensic anthropology testimony, anatomist testimony. But I think it illustrated early on the perils of overinterpreting the evidence. We all learn this. If we get involved in the legal process, you have to stay within your science. And if you're tempted to go outside of it, you can get burned rather badly. And I think Dorsey was burned, and we learned that lesson from that case.
And it's interesting, though, that still resulted in a conviction too. And I think that is a good example of how we're one piece of the puzzle, because most of that was based off circumstantial evidence. And I believe they found the ring of Lugard's wife with LL inscribed on it as well. So I think he only played like a really minor part, but you're right. This is now making anatomist anthropologists expert witnesses and giving credence to that discipline and what it can offer to the medical legal system. Could you summarize and contextualize the developments of forensic anthropology through the 19th century from Dwight through Bass?
That's a challenge, because there have been so many good people and so many critical developments. And we could be here for hours talking about all the people that contributed. But you want to start with Dwight, Thomas Dwight. His dates are 1843 to 1911. He was the Parkman Professor of Anatomy at Harvard. And this is the same Parkman that was killed earlier at Harvard. We have a professorship named in his honor, and he held that post. He wrote an essay in 1878, I believe, The Identification of the Human Skeleton, a Medical Legal Study. This won a prize, and basically was an academic presentation of this new science of forensic anthropology that was emerging. And for that, it is a very significant development. He also went on to publish on different aspects of forensic anthropology, sex and age evaluation of the sternum, looked at cranial suture closure, study of bone articular surfaces, got into the stature estimation game, etc. But Thomas Dwight started to build collections, launched an academic interest in these medical legal applications. And for that, T. Dale Stewart later gave him the title, the father of American forensic anthropology. I would then go to Harris Wilder, 1864 to 1928. He taught at Smith College. He was trained in Europe, but spent his career at Smith in Massachusetts. Basically published a lot in a key text on facial reproduction and the role in ID. This was a little bit on the periphery of the development of forensic anthropology, but identification was not. It was clearly in the center. And he did a lot on facial reproduction, how that could be used into the process. I would then turn to Ernest Houghton, also at Harvard, 1887 to 1954. Houghton did a lot. When I think of him in forensic anthropology, it's primarily for training. You know, he had that post at Harvard for a long time, and he trained many of the folks that went on to populate the universities and trained others. A lot of the academic pedigrees of forensic anthropologists in subsequent years can be traced back to Houghton and his work there at Harvard. He also did a lot to standardize measurements, kind of like Broca did in Paris, but Houghton at Harvard came up with standard approaches to taking measurements. He trained all these students. These students went out and took those measurements, and I think that was a major impact on the field. We then come to Elish Herdlitzka, 1869 to 1943. Herdlitzka, I know well. He founded the collections and the physical anthropology department where I work. He was a Czech immigrant, immigrated to the U.S. in New York with his parents. He was young at the time, got his medical degree, and studied under Broca in Paris, but ultimately became the first curator of then physical anthropology at the Smithsonian. He was, again, motivated by Lombroso to some extent in trying to test these armchair theories coming out of Italy with real data. He was a prolific researcher, got into the forensic arena primarily in that sort of indirect way, trying to look for normals that he could test this abnormal normal difference that was in the prevailing thought at the time that led him to build collections. And although not known for his work in forensic anthropology, he was discovered by J. Edgar Hoover in the FBI, who had their young laboratory right across the street from the Natural History Museum, where he worked and where I work today. And basically, they began to consult quietly with Herdlitzka on a variety of cases in his expertise. Not well known. He didn't publish much on it at all. And a lot of his work was really completely unknown. He had one student, and that was T. Dale Stewart, a name well known in forensic anthropology, and a name, again, close to my development. Stewart was head of my dissertation committee at the University of Kansas, and I was actually hired when T. Dale Stewart retired back in the day. Stewart's dates are 1901 to 1997. He basically continued to do the FBI work that Herdlitzka had quietly begun, but he did it in a more direct way. And he recognized that forensic anthropology was, in fact, becoming a subdiscipline of anthropology and forensic science, and published on it. When I think of T. Dale Stewart's contributions, it's bringing forensic anthropology out of the academic closet into the mainstream. He did a lot of specific publication work directly on the problems of forensic anthropology. Major contributions, his 1957 article with Tom McKern on skeletal age changes in young American males, 1979 text, The Essentials of Forensic Anthropology, his 1970 book on personal identification in mass disasters, are all classics in the field. But Stewart, in my mind, was the champion of the focused, detailed research project on a particular problem. He was really good at that. And he would identify a problem and devise a research strategy, do the work, and publish it. He has a long list of publications, a very, very prolific worker, and had an impact on the field in that way. Also did a lot of other things that involved casework and involvement. Wilton Krogman was a contemporary of Stewart. Krogman's dates are 1903 to 1987. Two major contributions is 1939, Guide to the Identification of the Human Skeletal Material. That 1939 guide was published by the FBI, I believe, and it was turned to by scores of workers after that date as kind of the Bible on how to approach skeletal material. Stewart used that before he developed his own materials. In 1962, Krogman wrote a more comprehensive volume, The Human Skeleton in Forensic Medicine, that has gone through some edits. But that too became a classic, and we all grew up learning from that volume. It was an exhaustive treatment of the literature at that time and was a valuable resource in just looking at everything that had been done. I have to mention J. Lawrence Angell, another Smithsonian colleague, 1915 to 1986. He did a lot of FBI casework. When T. Dale Stewart became director of our museum, J. Lawrence Angell was brought in from Philadelphia as a curator, and he took over the FBI work from Stewart at that time, worked on many cases over the years. But I think of Angell's major contribution is public exposure to the field. Larry Angell loved the media, whereas most of us kind of run the other way when the cameras show up. Larry Angell loved it. He really, I think, got a lot of high-profile public articles written, a lot of public exposure that brought public attention to the value of forensic anthropology. The name Ellis Curley comes to mind, 1924 to 1998. Curley, along with colleague Clyde Snow, were instrumental in the formation of the AAFS developments, the formation of the section that we talked about earlier, as well as the ABFA. He was a prime mover in that capacity. He was the first forensic anthropologist elected president of the AAFS. But in science, he was primarily known for his development of the microscopic technique. He published a couple of articles on how we can look inside the bone at microscopic structure to get at age estimation in what has been regarded as a relatively accurate method that's undergone a lot of refinement over the years. But Ellis Curley laid the foundation for that. I've already mentioned Clyde Snow, a contemporary of Ellis Curley at that time, 1928 to 2014 are his dates. Clyde Snow was instrumental with Curley in the formation of the AAFS developments. I think of Snow's major development in the global international humanitarian and human rights front. When Clyde Snow retired from government work, instead of going off to play golf, he got deeply involved in global issues of the application of forensic science and forensic anthropology in particular to issues of human rights and humanitarian concern. He began in Argentina in the 80s. He accepted the challenge of getting involved in the Argentine problems at that time, developed the Argentine team, and they, of course, have gone on, and Clyde Snow went on to work in many countries of the world to take on these types of issues. Through that development, many other organizations have been developed and prospered, but a lot of it goes back to Clyde Snow accepting the challenge to take that on. And I think that's the way I'll always remember him. William M. Bass deserves mention, initially at the University of Kansas, where I interacted with him primarily, and then at the University of Tennessee. Many contributions of Bill Bass. Two come to mind. One, of course, is the development of the Decay facility. His initiative in developing that facility has led to some incredible research, development of collections, and has spurned other facilities in different parts of the country and in the world. His human osteology text has been a classic that we've all used over the years. He initially developed that at the University of Kansas. I wrote the chapter on dentition in that book years ago as an undergraduate, but that book has been with us all this time and continues to be one of the best sources for human osteology. But I think of Bill Bass's primary contribution is teaching. It was certainly my experience as an undergraduate and graduate student at Kansas working with Bill Bass, and I know many, many others have prospered from his teaching ability and his willingness to let students get involved in his research. You know, that participation experience that he offered students has worked well over the years, and so many students have come out of those programs that have gone on to become leaders in the field today. I also need to mention Mildred Trotter, primarily working in St. Louis, is well known for her work with the development of stature equations, taking the stature estimations to a new level and a better statistical basis than previous attempts. But I look at Trotter very much like Stewart in that she was the champion of the small, detailed, intellectually focused study, where she would take on a project, devise research around it, take it as far as it would go, and publish it. She was very similar to Stewart in my mind that way. They both did a lot of major contributions and developed the field in that way. Alice Bruce deserves mention, 1913 to 2007. Alice Bruce did a lot of work on human variation, but I think of her primarily for, again, for her teaching, her training of anthropologists at Colorado. A lot of excellent colleagues came out of that program. I think that's, in my mind, her major contribution. Sheila Brooks deserves attention. 1923 to 2008, this is getting into recent times, and a colleague that many of us interacted with, great influence on the practice of forensic anthropology in her day, did key work on age estimation, cranial sutures, work on the pubis, is still with us today in an important work. So those are some of the major figures. There are many more, but in my mind, those are some of the highlights.
Given your experience, how has forensic anthropology changed through time, either for better or worse? And where do you think the field needs to go?
Well, the field of forensic anthropology has changed dramatically, even in my career. But certainly when you go back to the early 1900s, and you look where we are today, it is just amazing the changes that have taken place. I think of the major improvements that I see that I think are continue to be a need are more global collections. We started as a collection-based science, and we're still there. And what we've seen is the development with the global expansion of forensic anthropology to the formation of documented collections in different parts of the world. And these are so important and so valuable in documenting human diversity. I see that need is not going to go away. I think it's only going to get better in documenting human diversity. I think the other major change, obviously enhanced by the computer and good research, are large databases. You know, you go back 40 years and you look at the publications, the small little samples they were based on, the local samples, and now we see the possibility of developing huge databases that are diverse, that can take into account some of the human diversity that is so important. The statistical analysis, that's basically not new. You know, that kicked in the mid-1900s pretty strongly, but it has grown dramatically, primarily in more sophisticated approaches to get at the key issues of probability and error in forensic science. We have rigorous statistical procedures now that allow us to take a look at that. And when methods are available, it allows the field to assess the probabilities involved, what is the likelihood of error, and all that goes with that. The other key development I see is the employment range. And with that is the range of problems that we apply forensic anthropology to. We've gone beyond simple skeletal analysis, which continues, of course, an important contribution we make. But our anthropologists today are involved in working with the living, assessing age of the living, in working with other specialists in the assessment of trauma. They're entrenched in recovery teams and search and recovery efforts around the world. Basically, anthropologists are taking on more diverse problems in more complex ways, and that leads to an increase in the range of employment opportunities. Certainly, traditional employment in museums and universities continues, and that's a key part of the field, but we now see anthropologists employed in human rights investigations, in the military identification efforts, in a variety of contexts that didn't exist just a few decades ago. And this is good news for the emerging students that are coming along. We see the surge of interest in forensic anthropology on the part of young people coming into the field, which is, for an old timer like me, it is great to see, because there's the future and it really looks good. But the young people coming in need to see that there's a chance they're going to get employed one day. And that picture is improving with the expansion of the employment range of forensic anthropology.
Speaking of new students coming up in the field, what research do you think is missing that maybe they can utilize?
Well, what I see in the last few years, really, and continuing into the future, are more experimental approaches. We see some really thoughtful, sophisticated experimentation being done, particularly on trauma and taphonomic change, that really helps clarify a lot of the issues that are involved when we try to interpret trauma and taphonomic change in casework. And I think potential for new professional involvement in experimental research is really great. I think the other challenge that's really important is to look beyond our own field, to look at techniques that are emerging or already exist in other fields, and think how we can apply those techniques to our problems. Some of the best research that I've been associated with has been of that sort, identifying a problem that we encounter in forensic anthropology through casework, and then thinking, all right, what type of research can we do to get at that? And sometimes the answers to that question are found outside the field of forensic anthropology in neighboring areas.
So forensic anthropology has had several definitions through the years as our understanding evolves. Is there any particular definition that you think best encapsulates what forensic anthropology is now? And if not, do you have any suggestions onto what a more encompassing definition could be?
Well, the definition I like of forensic anthropology involves the application of the knowledge and methods of anthropology to medical legal issues. That's a general definition, but it recognizes that we don't control the medical legal issues that are presented to us, and they can be quite diverse, as we've talked about already. So what forensic anthropology has to do is to take these medical legal issues, these problems that are presented to us, and then look at what knowledge we have and what methods are available that we can apply them to. And I think that definition fits that type of application.
I love that definition because it is short, concise, and it allows room. It's flexible. It's dynamic. It can change as the needs presented on forensic anthropologists change. So the last thing, I know you have somewhere to be. Is there anything you'd like to plug? Are you up to any research now in particular you'd like to talk about? Is there anything happening in the Smithsonian?
Well, the projects I'm involved in right now, a lot of them focus on humanitarian and human rights issues. I see there is a continued need throughout the world for forensic anthropologists to find a way to contribute and to promote those types of contributions, either directly in casework or even better through training. My impression is that rather than go to a place where we have skills and can help with a case, we can do that. But along the way, if we can train others in how to do it, a capacity building, then you can leave behind a contribution that's much larger than just your contribution to an individual case. The other research project that I've done a lot of work on and I continue to have interest in is in using Bomker radiocarbon to get at birth and death dates. This basically looks at the post-1950 effects of artificial carbon-14 buildup due to nuclear testing in the atmosphere and how that high levels of radiocarbon get incorporated into the human skeleton, the human body through the food chain, and in dealing with identification of remains, how we can sample different tissues and relate it to that bomb curve to try to elucidate both the birth date and the death date. This is a technique of great interest to me because it allows us to get at a lot of the humanitarian and human rights issues of when did this person die and did that death relate to a particular event in the investigation. This is some research that I think can continue to contribute to those types of problems and I remain interested in.
So that's all the questions I have. Thank you so much for your time. The only other thing Nick Pasalacqua wanted to know, what do you think about Krogman having a PhD but writing a book called The Human Skeleton in Forensic Medicine, while Stuart had an MD but wrote a book called Forensic Anthropology?
Well, I think it's interesting when you go back to the Krogman-Stuart era at the educational levels and what they end up contributing in. Herdliska was in that same role. Herdliska had a medical degree, but ended up contributing to anthropology in major ways. I think it's just the nuance of the training back then. And to some extent, we see the same today in Europe, in other parts of the world, where some of the folks contributing to forensic anthropology development have medical degrees and not necessarily anthropology degrees. I don't feel that's much of an issue as long as individuals are properly trained, they have the knowledge and the ability to pursue the research goals that are in front of them. And I think Stuart and Krogman are good examples of that.
Thank you so much to Dr. Ubelacher for taking the time to sit down and chat. And thank you for listening. Again, we'll be back soon-ish. Be good.